We are back on the air. This is For the Record, and that is the Radio Entrepreneurs Legal Show, and that also means we're being sponsored by the law firm of Tarlow, Breed, Hart, and Rogers, and they are the supporters for the show on For the Record, and that means sitting to my left is my co-host, Mark Furman, from the law firm of Tarlow, Breed, Hart, and Rogers.
Hello, Mark. Hi, Jeffrey. Great to be with you.
Nice to see you again, Mark. Hope you had a good summer.
Awesome.
Good.
Very much looking forward to speaking with our next guest.
Good. Yes, our next guest I met recently, and quite impressive, because we're going to talk about, you know, I think a big chunk of what New England is all about in Boston, the innovation economy, and that means we're talking to Albert Sokol of McDermott, Will, and Emery. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to meet both of you guys.
Well, before we get into the innovation economy, I hope you don't mind. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself and the firm?
Sure. A quick thing about the firm and then something about me. The firm is a 20-office global law firm, McDermott, Will, and Emery, and I'm in the Boston office. In the U.S., we have 10 offices, and abroad, another 10. And I specialize in innovation work, technology, software, telecom, and on the other hand, life sciences, biotech. So that's the kind of work I do. And the firm specializes in that as well. And I'm pleased to be able to talk with you about it this morning.
Great. And I mean, you do a lot of work in that area. I mean, clearly this is a national firm which has an international footprint as well.
Yes.
Tell us, what are we seeing with the innovation economy? What's really going on?
Well, I can best answer that by giving you a few examples. If it's okay, I'll just give you some samples of some of the work that we've done that will help you get a sense of the scope.
That'd be great.
Yes, to me what matters is what matters to people. So working on a cure for tuberculosis or a vaccine that addresses all 9 strains of the human papillomavirus, the drug named Gardasil, or helping solve airline problems when people are delayed when they fly from city to city because there's a thunderstorm in Phoenix, but you're in Boston, but your plane's coming from Chicago. Those tasks of complexity, working with software companies that solve that, to cures for ADHD and so forth, those are examples of some of the work we've done and examples of what I think matters to all of us. And so you can see some of them are tech. Software and telecom and robotics. I didn't mention robotics. I've done work in robotics. And life sciences, which is where I've been spending more of my time recently than in tech.
I mean, clearly everything you've listed has implications to us living a better life.
It does, doesn't it? Yes.
But it also says to me, because I've been around lawyers long enough to know, you must have to do a lot of reading to really be up on these topics. You can't just be casual.
No, that's true. But you know, the first thing that I find with clients that you work with is that they sense that you care. If you care about their business, if you're interested in them and their success, they'll forgive you that you're not an expert in what they do. And usually the first task actually is to know the terminology. So the first large biotech deal I did was in the 80s. It was the world's first in vitro fertilization company. And frankly, I hadn't known what IVF was. It was the first company to do this. And they were born in Australia, and I helped them come to the States. So you learn the terminology and the process of landing a client and helping them. So I have a sociology degree from college, so what do I know, right? But if you're interested, you'll learn anything.
Did you learn your form of practicing the law by yourself, or did you have mentors?
No, I had no mentors as such, other than my parents, who encouraged me to, you know, the world is your oyster, that kind of parent, who encouraged you to seize opportunities and challenges, and so I did. I mean, that's part of what motivates me, is the next horizon. Sounds kind of fancy, but that's the way I think of it.
No, my mother tried to convince me of the same thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if that world exists as much as it did
a
while back. You know, I'm going to go back to one of the things you said earlier, tuberculosis. You must feel a sense of responsibility when you get involved with companies like this that are really going to change people. You really change people's lives and give them a life.
Right, right. You really care about it. And it's not just something you learn in law school and contracts class. You know, you have to have those tools. But I don't know, where does the sense of caring about the people you work with come from? I can't quite say. Maybe it's values, and maybe it's also fun, by the way, to work in the innovation economy, to anticipate that you're contributing to something that matters. It matters to you, it matters to your kids. You know, I can tell my kids what I do and I'm happy about it. And then you remind me of a conference I attended many years ago where the main speaker was an Australian fellow. And he was the scientist from Brisbane, Queensland in Australia, who discovered the science underlying Gardasil, the vaccine I mentioned against HPV. And he was coming to Boston to speak. And the week before he arrived in Boston, Australia's biggest business newspaper had a photo of him on the cover. He was the man of the week. And it had his name that said, God's gift to women. And he had a big grin on his face. And with that, he began his talk at the conference. And I thought, I know why he's smiling. It's not because he wants to be God's gift to women. It's because what he does matters. I thought that was pretty inspirational to me. And it stuck in my mind these years. It's about 20 years ago.
Oh, you know, in my coaching, what I have found always, that when I'm always trying to peel away the onion with high-achieving people, is really finding out what really is the flame in their life, and where was that, you know, and try to get them back to where their heart was and their mind, connect their heart and mind back into their work, because when I can do that, I have a fully energized and engaged person.
Yeah.
So many times when I don't have that, which is the majority of time, they're not fully engaged.
Yeah. That's one of the themes in my life. I guess the second is international. My wife is Danish, my kids are half Danish. I worked in Africa for almost 4 years. I was a micro venture capitalist, I guess you call it. Back in those days, they weren't handing out Nobel Prizes or anything, but that's what I was doing, was micro capital in Zambia primarily. So my life has also had this global, international, cross-border element forever, pretty much.
When were you there?
1970, 74, or thereabouts, and I helped set up basically a cooperative bank. In our lingo, that's what you'd call it, a cooperative bank for the country of Zambia. And I design accounting materials. This is with a sociology degree from college.
Mm-hmm. We have a friend who now builds bridges in Zambia.
Does he really?
Yeah.
There aren't many people I know who know Zambia. It's quite a far away.
I've been to Zambia.
Have you?
Yeah, just sort of my foot over the border, not much more.
Yeah, that's a very interesting place.
Where'd you grow up?
I grew up near Cooperstown, New York, the Baseball Hall of Fame. So I'm a country boy in derivation, I guess. And maybe that helps explain why I wanted to travel and have an international career, because I wasn't, you know, a little town with 1,000 residents in the farm
also,
country.
Maybe it also explains why you're all seem to always be excited about everything that you sort of encounter that's new.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I am, I guess, honestly.
So, do you see a lot of changes on the horizon? Our last guest talked about, you know, Amazon and Whole Foods and how disruptive it'll be to the whole food chain.
Absolutely.
You know, we might see wholesalers going away and the whole distribution channel. Right. You know, what kind of innovation do you think we're going to be seeing in the next few years that's really going to be affecting us?
Well, I'll give you a couple examples of things come to mind. One trend that we're seeing is an incredible degree, it's really remarkable, of activism from Chinese investors in American biotechs and pharmas. It almost feels like it's happened suddenly. It's not really suddenly, it's sort of ramped up. But every year I go to J.P. Morgan conference in San Francisco in early January. For about 15 years. It's a worldwide gathering of biotech and pharmaceutical company executives. And it was striking the last couple of years how many Chinese and Asian, Malaysian, Singapore, investors that work. So much so that, I don't know whether you know, we have a large Shanghai office in my firm, and I'll be going there in about a month to help be part of a McDermott team making a conference for Chinese investors in the United States. So, Chinese life science investors. So that's a real trend that's remarkable, and I think really good for our economy
and
for our innovators.
So the investment world really is flat.
It really
are no borders anymore.
It's really remarkable. That is right.
I think that's really what I'm getting out of what you're saying, that it really isn't, you know, I grew up in Canada, you had, you know, Canadian investors, and I moved to the States, American investors, and the Japanese and German side. It's really not. There's no real geography to invest
in. Not anymore. It's all about the opportunity and does it fit with what you want to do, whatever ROI you may have, whatever strategic imperative you may have, disease, diagnostics, whatever it might be. The world is flat, and people go looking for new innovations in this sector worldwide. This coming June 2008, there will be probably 20 or 30,000 people of this sort in Boston for a week at a conference in early June. And we'll be putting on, and I'll be chairing a sub-conference of our own for Asian investors at that event.
I feel like I'm listening to Professor Sokol.
Well, I guess I'll take it as a compliment.
Or Dean Sokol.
You should.
Dean Sokol. If somebody wants to learn more about you and the firm, maybe connect with you, how would they find you?
How would they find me? Well, I don't want to be too glib. We're on the internet. We have a really good website, McDermott, Will & Emery. I'm at 28 State Street downtown in the financial district, and would be happy to talk to anyone. As you perhaps can tell, I love telling people about what we do, and it's just fun to do that. So that's where I am.
And your email address
is asokol, A-S-O-K-O-L, at MWE.com.
Did you go to the Baseball Hall of Fame?
I have been there many times.
Okay.
Cooperstown's a great place to go.
Never been there.
It's fun.
It is great. My son, who played high school baseball, they had a game at Doubleday Field.
Oh, yeah?
So we all went up for the weekend.
My God. You know,
it was great fun.
One of the things that's fun about Cooperstown is there's more than just baseball there. I don't know. There are terrific museums of Indian history. And there's a natural history museum that has nothing to do with either Indians nor baseball. It's well worth a visit.
Lovely lake, as I recall.
Yeah.
There's a little golf up there, I recall. That's right.
There's a little golf. Yeah.
A little golf.
And it's only about a five-hour drive from Boston. So,
as I recall, it started snowing when I was on the golf course. In Cooperstown.
Makes it hard to find the ball, doesn't
it? This was in the spring. Makes
it hard to find the ball.
But it's a lovely little town. How did you end up in Boston?
Why Boston?
As I said, the town was really small, 1,000 people, and my school was really small, and my class was 45 graduates. So it was a small place. I was a country guy. I grew up on a farm. One day, a guy came walking down the street, and he was a family friend who we had known for about 15 years. I was then 18, and he walked up to me. Really, I didn't know he was coming. He said, "You need to go to Yale, and I'm going to help get you in." So he took me to New Haven and introduced me to people. And I applied, and I got into Yale, and it changed my life. I saw the wider world. It was an act of discovery. You know, I discovered what there was, what the possibilities were. And one of the most exciting times for me was picking up the course book, then called the Blue Book, and being so excited at all the opportunities. There in my hands, I could do anything I wanted to do. And that was really cool. So that was really the starting point for me.
Everything you really are a scholar.
Well,
that's
how can you not be excited by all the things you can do? It's just,
Well, you have to have the
My kids
capacity.
Are like that, too.
That's great. It's wonderful. You have to have that capacity to want to learn and do things. That's wonderful. You know, it's really been inspiring listening to you, truly.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's nice of you.
Thank you. And I'm sure people who were listening would find it inspiring. Albert, thanks for being on the show today. We hope we have you back again.
Well, thank you.
I always love being
inspired.
Appreciate
it. This has been fun. Nice to talk. There's lots we could talk about.
Right.
Yes.
We'll follow up with you, definitely.
Good.
And I want to thank again Mark Furman and the law firm of TBHR, who are sponsoring For the Record, and that's where we are, at the law firm of Tarla Reed, Hart & Rogers. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back after these messages on Radio Entrepreneurs.
Thank you.